Chapter 22. In late September, there were two notable deaths in one week. The first was Mr. Wilson Caudle. He died at home, alone, in the bedroom where he'd secluded himself since the day he walked out of the Times. It was odd that I had not spoken to him once in the 6 months I'd owned the paper, but I'd been too busy to fret over it. I certainly didn't want any advice from Spot. And sadly, I knew of no one who had either seen him or talked to him in the past 6 months. He died on a Thursday and was buried on a Saturday. On Friday, I hustled over to Mr. Mitlow's, and we had a wardrobe session regarding the proper funeral attire for someone of my stature. He insisted on a black suit, and he had just the perfect bow tie. It was narrow with black and maroon stripes, very dignified, very respectful. And when it was tied and I was properly turned out, I had to admit that the image was impressive. He pulled out a black felt fedora from his personal collection and proudly loaned it to me for the funeral. He said often that it was a shame American men didn't wear hats anymore. The final touch was a shiny black wooden cane. When he produced it, I just stared. "I don't need a cane," I said. It seemed quite foolish. "It's a walking stick," he said, thrusting it at me. "What's the difference?" He then launched into a baffling history of the crucial role walking sticks had played in the evolution of modern European male fashion. He felt passionately about it, and the more worked up he got, the thicker his accent became, and the less I understood. To shut him up, I took the stick. The following day, when I walked into the Methodist church for Spot's funeral, the ladies stared at me. Some of the men did, too, most of them wondering what the hell I was doing with a black hat and a cane. In a whisper just loud enough for me to hear, Stan Atcavage, my banker, said behind me, "I guess he's going to sing and dance for us." "Been hanging around Mitlow's again," someone whispered back. I accidentally whacked the cane on the pew in front of me, and the noise jolted the mourners. I wasn't sure what one did with a cane while one was seated for a funeral. I squeezed it between my legs and placed the hat in my lap. Portraying the right image took work. I looked around and saw Mitlow. He was beaming at me. The choir began Amazing Grace, and we fell into a somber mood. Reverend Klinkscale then recited Mr. Caudle's basics. Born in 1896, the only child of our beloved Miss Emma Caudle, a widower with no children of his own, a veteran of the First War, and for over 50 years the editor of our county weekly. There he brought to an art form the obituaries, which would forever be Spot's claim to fame. The Reverend rambled on a bit, then a soloist broke the monotony. It was my fourth funeral since landing in Clanton. Except for my mother's, I had never attended one before. They were social events in the small town, and often I heard such gems as, "Wasn't that a lovely service?" and "Take care, I'll see you at the funeral." And my favorite, "She would have loved it." She, of course, was the deceased. Folks took off work and wore their Sunday best. If you didn't go to funerals, then you were downright peculiar. Since I had enough oddities working against me, I was determined to properly honor the dead. The second death occurred later that night, and when I heard about it on Monday, I went to my apartment and found my pistol. Malcolm Vince was shot twice in the head as he left a honky-tonk in a very remote part of Tishomingo County. Tishomingo was dry, the tonk was illegal, and that's why it was hidden so deep in the sticks. There were no witnesses to the killing. Malcolm had been drinking beer and shooting pool, behaving himself generally and causing no trouble. Two acquaintances told the police that Malcolm left by himself around 11 p.m. after about 3 hours in the tonk. He was in good spirits and was not drunk. He said goodbye to them, walked outside, and within seconds they heard gunfire. They were almost certain he was not armed. The joint was at the end of a dirt trail, and a quarter of a mile up the road, a sentry guarded a passageway with a shotgun. In theory, his job was to alert the owner if the police or other unsavory characters were approaching. Tishomingo was on the state line, and there had historically been feuds with some hoodlums over in Alabama. Tonks were favorite places to settle scores and such. The sentry heard the shots that killed Malcolm, and he was certain no car or truck had fled the scene afterward. Any such vehicle would have had to pass by him. Whoever killed Malcolm had come from the woods on foot and carried out the hit. I talked to the sheriff of Tishomingo County. He was of the opinion that someone was after Malcolm. It certainly wasn't a garden-variety honky-tonk flare-up. "Any idea who might be after Mr. Vince?" I asked, desperately hoping that Malcolm had made some enemies 2 hours away.
"No idea," he said. "The boy hadn't lived here long."
For 2 days I carried the pistol in my pocket, then again grew weary of that. If the Pagets wanted to get me, or one of the jurors, or Judge Lupus, or Ernie Gaddis, or anyone they deemed guilty of helping send Danny away, then there was little we could do to stop them.